Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline across the top of the page, Falling Home Prices Spawn Perilous Ripple. And this article is written by Lee Weisbecker with the Dateline of Raleigh. It runs horizontally across the top of the page. On the far left, there's a picture of the outside of a very nice, large, three-story home with a big house for sale sign in front. The caption reads, Homes in Wake County are selling for 6% below assessed value on average. The housing price slump could continue to eat away at county and municipal tax bases and therefore collections, and that in turn could lead to the equally unpleasant alternatives of higher property taxes or additional cuts in government services. Such are the down-the-road implications contained in a new study showing that homes in nearly half of North Carolina's 100 counties are now selling below their assessed tax value. In Wake County, they are selling on average nearly 6% below tax value. In Durham, the figure is nearly 3%. Sales prices in Orange County are still slightly above assessed tax values. On the coast and in the mountains, where second and vacation homes abound, and the housing slump has been particularly pronounced, dwellings in New Hanover County on average are selling at 13% under assessed value, and the figure is a whopping 31% in mountainous Cherokee County. The data comes from the North Carolina Department of Revenue's 2011 Sales Assessment Ratio Study, an examination that takes a sampling of home sales in each county and compares the prices fetched to the home's assessed value in county tax records. In a healthy economy, home sale prices tend to move above the tax value, which is changed only when the county conducts a new property reevaluation, generally every 8 years in North Carolina. Historically, property tax revenues have grown even in bad economic times, says UNC Chapel Hill School of Government professor Chris McLaughlin, who recently blogged on the state tax study and its possible consequences. But the lasting effect of the Great Recession may put an end to the property tax's slow and steady growth. City and county tax bases, and therefore tax collections, would only be affected when future county property reevaluations begin to capture the lower home prices. In four counties that recently revalued property, Henderson, Lincoln, Brunswick, and Carteret, that's exactly what happened, and each saw their tax bases shrink. Such warning flags have led to talk in other counties about the advisability of putting off scheduled reevaluations until a later date, says Todd McGee of the North Carolina Association of County Commissioners. Some are thinking about backing off and waiting for the turnaround to happen, he says, and hopefully that turnaround will begin soon. County property tax revaluations put a value on any home by looking at comparable sales during the previous 3 years. Wake and Durham counties, which revalued in 2007 for the 2008 tax year, aren't required to do so again until 2015 to 2016. So far, during the recent downturn, slumping sales tax collections have bedeviled county officials with their volatility. Wake County's property tax base, the value of all the residential and commercial property, $121 billion in 2011 to 2012, has continued to grow by 1.5%, 0.5%, and 0.7% during the last three fiscal years, says Wake Revenue Director Marcus D. Kinraid. Those percentages could as well be described as flat or even falling, given inflationary factors. Will the value of the real property continue to go down, or will there be a recovery before our next revaluation in 2016? Kindred asks. It's too far out to tell, he says. And our next article is in the center of the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. And this article runs, this article has a black border around it. Inside that border, the top half is a picture. It's a picture of a woman dressed in a business suit standing at a podium with a big poster of Campbell University and NC State University behind her. The caption reads, Melissa Essery heads up Campbell's Law School. And then under that in bold black lettering is the headline, Get This, Schools of Law Now Shrinking. And then under that is the article, and this article was written by Chris Bagley with a Dateline of Durham. Law schools are looking at reducing the size of incoming classes, concerned that a sluggish legal industry and an increasing number of new schools are dooming too many graduates to unemployment. Triangle Universities reported 816 first-year students in August, down by about 5% from 2010. The number of so-called ILs, first-year law students, or excuse me, 1Ls, first-year law students, at North Carolina Central University in Durham fell most dramatically to 166 from 206 last year and from 222 in 2008. Dean Raymond Pierce has said he aims to reduce the school's enrollment to about 575 from the current 640, due partly to the difficult labor market. Campbell University took in 191 new law students in August after an unexpectedly large number of applicants accepted admission offers, Dean Melissa Essery says. The school aims for classes of about 160, a target it has hit in most recent years. Essery says she'd like to reduce the school's total enrollment from the current 475 to about 450. UNC Chapel Hill has kept its annual target at 250 for about 5 years, Assistant Dean Michael States says. It may be time for a revision, he adds. I would imagine that that conversation is going to happen this year. Numbers at Duke University have fluctuated, but the school has kept its target at about 210 students per class. Shrinking law school admissions reflect a number of developments, including concerns about the legal profession's ability to absorb new lawyers. Hiring has slowed dramatically, particularly among large private law firms that serve corporate clients. Annual surveys by an industry group show that nearly 10% of students graduating from Triangle Law Schools last year were still unemployed in February. Surveys have suggested that many recent grads are working outside of the legal field. Unprecedented weakness in the market for legal talent and in the economy as a whole has made it difficult to predict enrollment each year, law school administrators have said. The calculus has grown even more difficult recently due to hiring freezes and budget uncertainty in state and federal governments, which employ judges, criminal prosecutors, and regulatory attorneys. One economist recently estimated that schools are turning out 70% more graduates than job markets can absorb over the next 5 years. And law schools have continued to open at a dramatic pace, particularly in North Carolina. Elon University School of Law and Charlotte School of Law were founded in 2006, becoming the state's sixth and seventh. Charlotte School of Law, one of three for-profit institutions run by Infile Law Corporation, has grown to more than 500 students, and school officials have discussed their intentions to grow further. University officials say law schools tend to be profitable, allowing them, in effect, to subsidize other departments. Applications to law schools surged in 2009 and 2010, which law school representatives say could represent a lack of immediate career options for a growing number of students. Law schools in the Triangle and elsewhere say they received about 20% fewer applications this year than last year, and officials suggest this may be the result of concerns that the resulting debt burden after 3 years, frequently $100,000 or more, could be insurmountable. Dean Paul Berman of George Washington University Law School in the District of Columbia says that concern has led George Washington Law to shrink enrollment, even though he says it's not clear that schools are turning out too many graduates. And our next story runs along the bottom of the page, on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal, and it has a sort of a greenish khaki background behind it. The headline, claim BNY Mellon bilked Duke, North Carolina Treasury in $2 billion fraud. And this article is written by Jason DeBrun with a Dateline of Durham. Duke University and the North Carolina Department of the State Treasurer could be in line for a settlement payout in a dispute with Bank of New York Mellon. BNY Mellon is alleged in a lawsuit to have defrauded institutions out of $2 billion in foreign exchange trading over 10 years, and Duke and the North Carolina Treasurer are among 138 entities listed as potentially having investments with BNY Mellon. Duke sought an investment relationship with BNY Mellon in March of 2000. The state treasurer did the same in March of 2006. Among institutions mentioned in the lawsuit are the Walt Disney Company, Fidelity Investments, Best Buy, and Cigna. According to two similar lawsuits filed by New York Attorney General Eric T. Schneiderman and U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, Preet Bharara, BNY Mellon, quote, has collectively defrauded its custodial clients of hundreds of millions of dollars, unquote. When trading in foreign currency exchanges, sometimes called FX trades, BNY Mellon allegedly lied about the exchange rate it actually received, according to the lawsuit. It would claim a lower rate to the client and keep the difference between the lower rate it reported and the actual rate it received, the complaint alleges. BNY Mellon consistently misrepresented to customers the rates it would give foreign currency transactions. According to the New York Attorney General's office, instead of providing the best interbank rates as promised, BNY Mellon gave the worst or nearly the worst rates of the trading day. To be sure, the profit made off each trade is measured in pennies, but for a bank that has $25 trillion in assets under custody and administration, those pennies can add up to about $2 billion in this case, according to the lawsuit. A public information officer for the U.S. Attorney's Office said there is no breakdown of how much of the $2 billion Duke or the North Carolina treasurer would stand to receive. Duke officials declined comment through spokesman Michael Schoenfield. Duke's endowment grew to $5.7 billion this year, but the university declined to say how much was invested in foreign exchange markets or if it had any money outside the endowment invested in BNY Mellon. A representative of the treasurer's office says BNY Mellon was custodian of the state's pension fund for retirees, which has assets of $74.9 billion, and provided this statement. The treasurer's office takes seriously litigation against custodian banks concerning excess charges for foreign exchange trades and securities lending losses, and is actively reviewing any claims that it may have. Besides investments, the bank has other ties to Duke as well. BNY Mellon Chairman, President, and CEO Gerald Hassel serves on the Duke University Board of Trustees and received an MBA from the Duke Fuqua School of Business. BNY Mellon spokesman Kevin Haney says Hassel's connection to Duke has nothing to do with any allegations made about the bank and questioned why that would even be brought up. Mr. Hassel has a distinguished record in his service to Duke, Haney says. It would be inappropriate to link this misguided lawsuit to his ongoing commitment to the school. In a statement released after the lawsuit was filed, BNY Mellon denied all allegations. The claims in this lawsuit are flat-out wrong, both on the law and on the facts, according to the bank. They reflect a fundamental misunderstanding by the Attorney General and his staff of the role of custodian banks and the operation of institutional FX, foreign exchange, markets. And we have one last article on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. This one written by Jason DeBrun with a Dateline of Wilmington. The headline, Investors See Big Value with CROs. And under this article, there's a picture, a large picture from the ground looking up at a large building with lots of glass and PPD written at the very top of the building. The caption reads, PPD Corporate Headquarters in Wilmington. When two private equity groups take PPD private, as they hope to do this winter, the move will stand as yet another example of the fact that investors see high value in the clinical research organization, or CRO, industry. The Carlyle Group and Hellman & Friedman made an offer to buy Wilmington-based Pharmaceutical Product Development Incorporated for $3.9 billion, a 30% premium over what shares were trading before the announcement. That would make it the largest CRO buyout in history, but hardly the only one. In fact, just since mid-2010, there have been at least seven other CRO mergers or acquisitions, including two in the Triangle, an area that employs 10,000 in the industry. CROs, often called contract research organizations, contract with groups to do research. PPD contracts with pharmaceutical manufacturers to test drugs in development. An examination of CRO buyouts shows that private investors place a higher value on CROs than do traders on Wall Street. The offer for PPD is 34% higher than the $2.9 billion market capitalization the company had this month. By another metric, the offer is 25 times PPD's average annual net income and 2.5 times its average annual revenue. Other CRO buyouts show similar figures. Last year, Inc. Research bought Kendall International and took it private. The $15.25 offer per share represented a 51% premium over the 30-day average of Kendall stock closing price before the acquisition. Although Kendall reported a net loss for 2010, the buyout represented 20 times the CRO's three-year average annual income. Another CRO, PRA International, was taken private in 2007 for $797 million. That offer was 30 times the company's average annual income. Analysts believe that the CRO industry has a bright future. Clinical trials for new drugs are cumbersome and costly. CROs present a way for drug manufacturers to save money by outsourcing the work. If pharmaceutical companies stick to their core competency, developing the chemical makeup of a drug, and CROs stick to their core, test that drug, it could bring down the cost of bringing a drug to market, which now is estimated to cost about $2 billion. There is going to be room for growth in the CRO industry, says GARP Research and securities analyst Alastair McKay, who tracks PPD. Numbers from the Association of Clinical Research Organizations back that up. Since the association was founded in 2001, revenue for all CROs has grown by 156% at a compound annualized rate of 11%, according to a survey of ACRO members. Projections from analyst group Raymond James & Associates show PPD increasing its net income to $240 million by 2013, nearly double what it reported in 2010. James Kumpel, an analyst for BB&T Capital Markets, sees more value in PPD as well. Even though the $33.25 per share offer was above what the stock was trading for, and historically big for the sector as he put it, it was at the low end of the $33 to $38 range for which he had PPD stock pegged. Kumpel says BB&T makes a market in PPD securities and expects to provide investment banking services to the company over the next 3 months. PPD employs 11,000 around the world, including nearly 1,400 in the Triangle who do clinical development work. A PPD spokeswoman says nothing in the day-to-day operations would change should the sale go through, but did not elaborate. Karen H. Bechtel, managing director and head of the healthcare group at Carlyle, says only that we look forward to helping expand and enhance PPD's platform and broad spectrum of therapeutic expertise, but neither she nor a Carlyle spokesman would give further details about the future of PPD or what the exit strategy for the investment groups might be. By privatizing the company, it allows the leaders to focus on long-term goals instead of quarterly earnings reports, Kumpel said. He thought it logical to think the investment groups would grow the company and look to take it public again in as few as 2 years. And now we turn inside the Triangle Business Journal to the Biz column. The headline that starts it off, it may take $50 just to apply at Kenan Flagler. And under that, there's a picture of the with a caption that reads, UNC's business school may charge a fee to applicants. And there's a picture of the part of the campus at UNC. Free rides might be at an end for students who want to major in business at Kenan Flagler in Chapel Hill. School officials are considering implementing a $50 fee for anyone who wishes to apply for admission. The fee would be used to cover the cost of application readers and interviewers. It would be the only school at the university to implement such a fee, although there is a general undergraduate application fee. About 52% of applicants to Kenan Flagler are admitted. More than 275 of the Triangle's leaders in business, development, and lawyering converged on North Hills on the evening of October 3 to celebrate the opening of Kilpatrick Townsend Stockton's new office on the 14th floor of the CapTrust building on Six Forks Road in Raleigh. Seen in the crowd were John Kane, developer of North Hills, Tim Smith and Bubba Rawl of the Preston Development Group, Tom Booth of Hardin Construction, Red Cross of the Triangle Executive Director Barry Porter, Ken Atkins, Executive Director of Wake County Economic Development, and Jim Beck, CEO of Trust Atlantic Bank. The soiree also drew Kilpatrick Chairman Bill Doris and partner Diane Puccino, one of Doris's two lieutenants, from the firm's Atlanta office, and partners from Kilpatrick offices in Charlotte and Winston-Salem. Kilpatrick Townsend Stockton is the product of a recent merger of Kilpatrick Stockton, whose largest offices were in the Winston-Salem and Atlanta, and Townsend & Townsend, an intellectual property firm with five offices in California. Old Liberty Golf Course is not operating at the moment, but at least it refunded a charity down payment. Last month, the Spinal Cord Society Raleigh chapter put down a $500 deposit to hold a fundraising golf tournament on September 26. On September 8, however, the course closed without warning, and Stephanie Sierra Mataro, the society chapter president, lost communication with club representatives, including developer Richard Wolf. She emailed Wolf explaining the situation, but feared she would not hear any response. Then last week, when she opened her mailbox, she found a letter that really made her day. Wolf sent her a check for $600, a full $100 more than the deposit. Wolf could not be reached for comment. Michael Bailey, who is credited with upgrading St. Timothy's School during his 16-year tenure as headmaster, is retiring. He will leave office on June 30, 2012. The St. Timothy School Board of Directors, chaired by the Reverend J.C. James, will serve as the search committee for the new head of school. The board has retained an educational consulting firm and has begun the search for a new headmaster who will build on Mike's legacy and lead us into the future, James tells Biz. During his 16-year tenure, Bailey was the driving force behind improvements to campus facilities and the addition of a middle school program. In addition, he oversaw upgrades and enhancements to curriculum and methodologies. "I am pleased when I look back and see what we have accomplished during my time here," Bailey says. "Our students are well prepared for the ever-changing world they enter when they leave St. Timothy's. A Raleigh company, My Mobile Dealer, introduced a new app for iPhone and Android platforms at the Digital Dealer Conference in Las Vegas. The app serves a dual purpose, helping auto dealers and helping their customers. For dealers, the app provides guidebooks from Kelley Blue Book and Black Book, Carfax, and AutoCheck Access, pricing trends, sales tools, and the ability to directly communicate with their customers. The customer mode allows vehicle owners to schedule service appointments, view and print service records, make loan payments, find fuel prices, read about safety recalls, and more. The app also utilizes VIN and QR scanners to decipher vehicle information. It's another example of the bright, vibrant software market alive in our market. Best wishes to My Mobile Dealer CEO Nick Gentry and crew. Taking a cue from students at NC State University, the matriculants at UNC Chapel Hill have launched the Dozen Donut Dash. Roomies Ty Fenton and Bobby Mook confess to modeling the run on the annual Krispy Kreme Challenge that attracts thousands to downtown Raleigh. The Chapel Hill run, which was on Saturday, September 30, attracted far fewer, a little over 100, but it did raise $11,700 for the UNC Lineberger Cancer Center. Fenton says the idea came to him when Krispy Kreme opened a store on Franklin Street last year, providing the fuel for the runners, who ran 2.5 miles from the old well, downed 12 Krispy Kreme donuts, then ran a 1.5 mile finish loop. Finishing eighth was 13-year-old Eli Rose, who told the Daily Tar Heel afterward that he felt good. "It might be the sugar," conceded young Eli. Burger chefs from 7 Red Robin Gourmet Burgers restaurants in the region will be going patty to patty in a competition in Raleigh on October 13 to see who can make the best smiling burger. The Red Robin restaurant at the Alexander Place Promenade Shopping Center in Northwest Raleigh will be host to one of the 7 Smiling Burger semifinal events nationwide for a shot at moving on to the January 2012 championship in Riviera Maya, Mexico, where one Red Robin chef will be named Smiling Burger Champion. In the Triangle, Red Robin also has locations in Cary, Wake Forest, Apex, and Durham. Red Robin bills itself as the Smiling Burger Expert. 9 of the 10 members of the Luxury Home Marketing Group tossed away their smartphones and temporarily tucked away their competitive streaks to mark the group's 7th anniversary with a September retreat and strategy session in Myrtle Beach. Members of the Luxury Home Marketing Group are Triangle real estate agents who focus on the sale of homes in the $750,000 and up range. While we can be fierce competitors with one another, the Luxury Home Marketing Group collaborates because we also focus on our client lists, says Group President Kathy Beecham. Member Linda Lee hosted at a beachfront condominium at Kingston Plantation. Vice President Linda Kraft, Secretary Jill Reckock of Old Raleigh Real Estate LLC, Treasurer Sean Britt of Realty World Triangle Living, and past President Kimberly Conroy completed the 2011 Executive Board. Steina DeAndrade, Brenda Holden, Linda Kolaroff, Linda Lee, and Deborah Nance are also in the group's 2011 membership. If you want to know what it's like to control 30% of the beer market, come to the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, Keenan Flagler Business School on Monday evening, October 10. Tom Long, CEO of Miller Coors, will give a free lecture open to the public at 5:30 in the Corey Auditorium. He is no stranger to Chapel Hill as he graduated from the university with a bachelor's degree in 1981. Registration is available online. Students at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill will get to skip classes to celebrate University Day on October 12. That's the day UNC celebrates its history as the nation's first public university. The campus first celebrated University Day in 1877. System President Thomas W. Ross will give the keynote speech. Classes will be canceled from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. Contributing to Biz were staffers Jason DeBrun, Amanda Jones-Doyle, Chris Bagley, and Monica Chen. Now we return to our full-length articles in the Triangle Business Journal. The first one we come to is written by Amanda Jones-Hoyle with a Dateline of Raleigh. The headline, Raven JVs with Deep-Pocketed New York Firm. The Raven Partners multifamily firm that was spawned in the spring following a corporate shakeup at Crossland has teamed up with a New York real estate investment firm that brings a war chest of $2.3 billion in capital commitments to the table. Raven is forming a joint venture with Northwood Investors LLC of New York City, which is led by former Blackstone Real Estate Advisors President and CEO John Cookrall. Charlotte and Raleigh-based Raven will be restructured as Northwood Raven LLC to focus on property management, residential development, and construction services on apartment projects across the Southeast. Northwood Raven, led by former Crossland Multifamily Division President David Raven, also has reached an agreement with Crossland to acquire a part of Crossland's remaining property management department. The deal includes management contracts for 16 apartment properties with 3,100 units in North Carolina and 95 people on its staff. The acquisition boosts Northwood Raven's employee roster to 120 people, says Raven. Terms of the deal were not disclosed. The deal with Northwood helps accelerate the construction timeline for what is now Northwood Raven's proposed $21 million St. Mary's Square apartment project in downtown Raleigh. Raven paid nearly $3 million in September for 1.3 acres on the half block bound by St. Mary's, Johnston, and Gaston Streets, which is two blocks from Glenwood Avenue. The project is slated for 134 apartment units that Raven hopes will replicate the success of the 712 Tucker apartment complex in downtown Raleigh that he helped build for Crossland in 2009. Demolition of the St. Mary's Square site is slated to begin in November, with the first units ready for occupancy in early 2013. Northwood Raven also has assumed, from Crossland, control of construction and management of apartment projects underway for Chapel Hill North and Chapel Watch in Chapel Hill, and Trinity Commons at Irwin in Durham. Strong demand for apartments and limited new supply have pushed the average occupancy rate to 93.3% for apartments in the Triangle, the market's highest level in more than 10 years, according to an August survey by the apartment research firm Real Data of Charlotte. Rental rates also are increasing, with new apartment complexes generating an average unit rate close to $1,200 per month. A lot of people are poised to build apartments, but not all are breaking ground, says Charles Dalton, principal of Real Data. Financing is still an issue, at least not real quick lending. Dalton says that a number of apartment builders across the country have been targeting apartment projects in North Carolina because of its high occupancy rate, but he adds the decision makers at Northwood Raven may have a home field advantage. They've been looking at these sites for years and know which ones they were interested in, he says. Raven says Northwood Raven has a number of additional development deals pending for projects in Cary and in Durham, but the company is also trying to expand its footprint into other parts of the southeast. It recently purchased 2.3 acres in Richmond, Virginia, for a 200-unit project called Manchester on the James, and it is negotiating to buy land in Atlanta for a 345-unit project, which is expected to close by the end of the year. In a statement, Northwood Investors President and CEO John Zuckerl says the joint venture with Raven will enable the firm to diversify its portfolio into the residential market in the southeast. We look forward to working with an experienced and award-winning multifamily team to pursue growth opportunities. And our next article is in the center of the page, has a black border around it. Inside that border, the top part, the top half, is a large picture of a rail yard with a lot of trains on the tracks. And across that, there's a beginning of the headline in bold white lettering, On the Rise. And then under that, the rest of the headline, the subheadline in black lettering, Shippers say rail costs are increasing as competition wanes among railroad haulers in North Carolina. And this article was written by Chris Bagley with a dateline of Salisbury. Once counted upon as a reliable and cost-efficient way to ship bulk goods, the cost of transporting freight by rail has been steadily rising in the nation and in North Carolina, raising the ire of manufacturers. Railroad companies, meanwhile, are enjoying the reality of less competition and steadily rising profits. For their part, they say their business is very expensive to operate. As recently as the early 1980s, the U.S. was served by a dozen-plus railroad companies. Today, that number stands at four that control 90% of the market. Meanwhile, railroads' profitability had been on an upswing. CSX, for example, reported net earnings of $1.56 billion during a weak economy in 2010, up from about $1.3 billion in pre-recession 2006. Revenue per unit shipped has been growing at an average of 6.4% per year, according to its annual reports. Paying the freight are the likes of aggregates processor Carolina Stylite, in Salisbury, ironically the historic center of railroading in North Carolina. Carolina Stylite sales manager Paul Hoban says the cost of shipping has risen steeply over the past 5 years and more than doubled since early 2010. If that's the only way to ship, you've got to pay, Hoban says. According to an analysis by Scott Group, an analyst at freight research firm Wolf Trahan, rail prices steadily declined between 1980 and 2004. Then, for the next 7 years, rail rates moved upward at a rate of 6% a year. That, says Group, compares to price increases for freight shipped by trucks and air of 1 to 2% a year. Manufacturing industry groups say rates are particularly high for so-called captive shippers, those that have access to only one rail hauler. That group has grown as the number of railroads has shrunk. Shippers say a large portion of recent increases have come in the form of fuel surcharges. Captive shippers pay as much as 6 times what railroads spend on fuel, labor, and other variable costs, claims Consumers United for Rail Equality, or CURE, a Washington, D.C.-based coalition of electrical utilities, chemical manufacturers, loggers, and cement companies. Other shippers pay 50% to 100% more than such variable costs, CURE Executive Director Bob Sabo says. Importers often get by with markups of just 30 to 40% because large container ships generally have their choice of ports, Zabo says. They've set up a system that benefits imports and hurts exports, Zabo says. CSX Corporation and Norfolk Southern Corporation dominate railroading east of the Mississippi River. While both connect to Charlotte, Raleigh, Durham, Winston-Salem, and Fayetteville, most other areas of the state depend on one or the other. Wilmington, notably, is served only by CSX, a fact highlighted by State Department of Transportation officials in testimony before federal railroad regulators in June. NCDOT Chief Operating Officer Jim Trogdon told regulators that CSX has quoted rates from Wilmington to Charlotte that are twice as high as truck rates and more than double the rates from Savannah, Georgia, and Charleston, South Carolina, which are served by both major railroads. While the majority of freight shipped within the U.S. travels by truck, a number of industries rely on rail, including relatively low-margin commodities such as lumber, coal, sand, and grain. Many chemicals are restricted from highways where they could pose health dangers. Chemicals accounted for 29% of rail tonnage originating in the state in 2009, and lumber and wood for about 14%, according to the American Association of Railroads. Coal, the leading fuel for power plants in the state, accounted for 55% of the tonnage that terminated in the state in 2009. A spokeswoman for the Railroad Association says the industry has to charge what it does, noting that railroad companies pay wages that are far above other blue-collar industries. And the industry plows about 17% of its revenue into capital expenditures, compared to an average of 5% in other industries, says Holly Arthur. Railroads spent $12 billion last year on expansions and improvements, such as widened tunnels, not counting maintenance of current facilities, Archer says. Railroads are incredibly capital-intensive, she says. Novon closes on $6 million fundraiser. That's the headline on our next story. This one's written by Monica Chen with the Dateline of Durham. Novon Incorporated has closed on a $6 million Series C round that will allow the Durham Biopharmaceutical Company to move forward with clinical testing of products made from nitric oxide. The company will make hires furthering clinical development. Currently, it has more than 20 employees, up from 10 in 2009. One position is open currently for a quality assurance manager. The company also has expanded its space from about 3,000 square feet to 12,147 square feet in Royal Center on Emperor Boulevard. Novon has been developing products using nitric oxide, a chemical compound that can be put into various uses, including as an antibacterial coating for medical devices and as a topical cream. Novon now has 5 product candidates with different indications on bacteria and infections. One lead product, a topical product focusing on antimicrobial indications, is heading into clinical evaluation, says CEO Nathan Stasko. Stasko says the potential uses for nitric oxide are wide-ranging. It's a single agent with a tremendous spectrum of application, Stasko says. We're translating it into real-world solutions. The company has attracted investors who also see huge potential in the compound. Those investors include Neil Hunter, co-founder and president of Cree Incorporated, and Bob Ingram, general partner of Hatteras Venture Partners. To date, the company has raised $9 million in private equity and warrants and $7 million in federal and state grants prior to closing the Series C. Novant had raised $4 million of its round in January. It raised $2 million in a Series B and $1 million in Series A. Nitric oxide, or nitrogen monoxide, is a free radical that was Molecule of the Year in 1992 and has been indicated as a possible treatment for diseases ranging from diabetes to schizophrenia. In 1998, three scientists won the Nobel Prize in Physiology and Medicine for discoveries concerning nitric oxide as a signaling molecule in the cardiovascular system. Nitric oxide has somewhat of a spotlight on its potential uses as the result of its novelty as a short-lived gas agent in the human body. This was a new phenomenon, said Professor Sten Lindahl of the Nobel Committee during the award presentation in 1998. The discovery that the endothelial factor was nitric oxide also initiated new therapies in clinical medicine, improved diagnostic capabilities for serious inflammatory diseases, and opened up new possibilities for drug development. Hunter says Novant is on a fast trajectory in developing products from the compound. We're moving at light speed. The fact that we're making our own API internally and doing our own formulation speaks volumes for a company our size, Hunter wrote in an email. It gives us a level of control that is the primary factor in our speed. And our next article, it's written by Monica Chen with a Dateline of Research Triangle Park. The headline, Mustard Tree Blooms as New Cash Fills Its Coffers. And next to this article, there's a picture of a man wearing a white coat sitting in a lab. And the caption reads, Todd Blondshein Heads Up Mustard Tree. Mustard Tree Instruments is growing from a small mustard seed into a sizable company. The drug analysis device maker in Research Triangle Park raised about $4.8 million in July and recently expanded from 5,400 to 14,000 square feet of office and research space. The company now employs 22 people and 19 sales representatives across the country. Most of the company's local staff are full-time employees, with a handful of contractors. Six people have been hired so far in 2011. And CEO Todd Blondshein expects two more hirings by the end of the year. In the next 24 months, the company will double its employment with new employees in manufacturing, service, sales, marketing, and additional R&D. All of this has been the result of the company launching its product, the VTT-1000, a drug analysis device the size of a coffee maker that can be used on the factory floors of drug manufacturers. Mustard Tree is now posting $2 million in annual revenue. Ultimately, our goal is to be a serial producer of this equipment, Blondshein says. We've got our first instrument out, and the next product will be released at the end of the year. We want to be a significant player in the instrumentation industry. Mustard Tree's products cater to the pharmaceutical manufacturing market, and Blondshein says that given the state of recalls and the cost of manufacturing, Mustard Tree's products will continue to be in demand. According to the National Institute of Pharmaceutical Technology and Education, it costs more than $1 billion to take a drug to market. Cost of goods for brand-name drugs can be up to 30% of total sales. By contrast, the cost of research and development is 10 to 15% of total sales. The contract manufacturing industry in the U.S. generated revenue of about $22.5 billion through the end of 2009 and is expected to grow by about 11% during 2011 to 2013, according to a report by Research and Markets. The leading pharma companies in the market are also looking at this model as a means to expand into the biosimilars and generic segments, the report stated. The problem the industry has is they make the product and then they test to make sure it's good, Blondshein says. Until the supply chain issues of the past decade, it has worked, but now it's not just local. Most of the raw materials come from China, India, and the supply chains are poor there. Mustard Tree uses Raman spectroscopy, a technology that analyzes solids by using a laser to vibrate molecules, causing a Raman shift that can be interpreted as the fingerprint of a molecule. Raman is a very useful technique for identifying solids. If they've developed a portable instrument, it would be very useful, says Prabir Basu, executive director of NIPTE. The NIPTE seeks to promote technology and science that would prevent events such as the 2008 contamination of heparin, a blood-thinning drug that led to the death of 81 people in the U.S. The contamination's cause was traced to adulterated supplies from China. For Mustard Tree, then, Blanchine sees a clear market opportunity. The company will address the market in North America and Europe directly with expanding sales and marketing, and will seek strategic partners in Asia. Our niche is that we go into a plant that's doing testing, and we do it much faster, and we do that testing much closer to the manufacturing line, Blanchine says. We call that lab to line. We allow manufacturers to not manufacture at risk. And now we turn to a section in the Triangle Business Journal called A Better World. And it's a page that's divided up into three sections. And we'll read through each of the three sections. The official title at the top is A Better World, News About People and Groups in the Triangle Making a Difference with Their Giving and Philanthropic Activities. Now the first section is Nonprofit News. Umicore Building Products USA, headquartered in Raleigh, has donated $70,000 worth of Pigmento Red VMZ standing seam zinc panels to be used for the roof of the American Institute of Architects North Carolina chapter's new modern sustainable headquarters building that is now under construction in downtown Raleigh. Stroud Roses, a nonprofit foundation that supports projects in the Chapel Hill and Carrboro area, will host a ceremony to celebrate a decade of community support on Sunday, October 9, from 3 p.m. to 5 p.m. in the Gene Stroud Rose Garden located in the Community Center Park at 120 South Estes Road, Chapel Hill. During the past 10 years, Stroud Roses has provided almost $4 million to fund 516 grants to 220 different organizations throughout the Chapel Hill and Carrboro area. Disability Rights North Carolina has received the state's highest honor for nonprofits from the North Carolina Center for Nonprofits. The annual Nonprofit Sector Stewardship Award recognizes organizations that use exemplary practices to be sure they earn the public's trust every day. We selected Disability Rights North Carolina for its successful use of a dozen different tools to improve public policies and services for people with disabilities, says Jane Kendall, president of the North Carolina Center for Nonprofits. And the second section of the A Better World page is the column by Todd Cohen, the Philanthropy News Desk. The headline of it, Easter Seals UCP Plans Growth Strategy. And along with the column, there's a picture of a man in coat and tie standing outside of an Easter Seals office with the their sign above his head. The caption reads, Connie Cochran heads up Raleigh's Easter Seals UCP, North Carolina. In a program, Raleigh-based Easter Seals UCP, North Carolina and Virginia is piloting in Rocky Mount and Mount Airy. Nurse practitioners at its local mental health clinics assess patients to identify their needs and then link them with primary care doctors. The patients can develop a relationship over time. The goal of the program, funded over 3 years with a $300,000 grant from the Kate B. Reynolds Charitable Trust in Winston-Salem, is to produce better outcomes at lower cost than the traditional practice of simply referring patients to primary care doctors, a practice that typically produces limited success because patients often do not show up at the doctor's office. That goal reflects the overall strategy at Easter Seals UCP in the face of rising healthcare costs and a shifting business model for delivering services in the areas of mental health, developmental disabilities, and substance abuse, says Connie Cochran, the agency's president and CEO. We're trying to minimize the amount of money we spend on administrative costs and maximize what we do on impacting services, he says. Easter Seals UCP was formed in 2004 through the merger of Easter Seals and UCP, or United Cerebral Palsy. The merger reflected a strategic decision the two agencies made in the face of efforts to reform the state's mental health system by moving from direct delivery of services by government to its management of services provided by private contractors. Today, after a series of subsequent mergers with smaller organizations, Easterseals UCP serves 20,000 people in North Carolina and Virginia and operates with an annual budget of $85.6 million and a staff of 1,100 people working full-time and 1,500 working part-time or under contract. The agency partners with community-based organizations to help individuals with disabilities or mental health problems, or both, function on a daily basis. Cochran says he expects more consolidation as the state's mental health system continues to shift to managed care. The roughly 30 or more area authorities throughout the state that had provided services directly have been replaced with about 20 local management entities that are expected to be consolidated to 10 or 12 by 2013. Those local management entities will be looking for more comprehensive providers who can eventually take on greater risk by agreeing to work with certain target populations, Cochran says. That will require that providers like Easterseals UCP have more robust information management systems that provide real-time data to know where you're spending money to get the best outcomes, he says. To pay for developing innovative new programs to do that, Easterseals UCP plans over the next 3 years to increase to $7 million from $5 million, the funds it raises each year through cause-related marketing and gifts of $25,000 or more. The agency, for example, receives $2.2 million a year through Shop and Care, a cause-related partnership it has had with Food Lion for 20 years. What we're trying to do, Cochran says, is use our money for more innovation for things that truly make a long-term impact. And the last section of A Better World is People on the Move. Martin Eakes, co-founder and CEO, Self-Help in Durham, was named to the Ford Foundation's Board of Trustees. Nancy McFarland, president of MedPro RX Incorporated, will be inducted into the YWCA Academy of Women at the organization's 29th annual Academy of Women Awards ceremony in November. Mort Congleton, vice president of development at Wake Technical Community College and executive director of the Wake Tech Foundation, was named president-elect of the board of directors of the Council for Resource Development in Washington, D.C. Matt Strickland, former senior director of the Y Guides at the YMCA of the Triangle, was named executive director of Band Together NC. And with our remaining few minutes, we'll read from TriangleBusinessJournal.com. Here are some of the news you may have missed on TBJ's website. Campbell Law School Dean stepping down. Melissa Essery, Dean of the Campbell University, Norman Adrian Wiggins School of Law, announced she will relinquish her duties as dean after 6 years to return to teaching full-time. She plans to make the move to the classroom in the fall semester of 2012. Essery, the first female dean of the law school, led the relocation efforts that moved the school from Buies Creek to downtown Raleigh in September 2009. Campbell Law School has always been dedicated to producing great lawyers, and our ability to do so has been greatly enhanced by our Raleigh location, Essery said in a written statement. Highwood sells $21.5 million in assets. Raleigh-based Highwoods Properties Incorporated said Wednesday that it has sold $21.5 million worth of commercial real estate assets in two separate deals. Highwood said that on September 28, it sold an office property located at 150 Stratford in Winston-Salem and an adjacent 3-acre undeveloped site for $15 million to an undisclosed buyer. The five-story, 135,533-square-foot building was 80% leased. We are pleased to complete the sale of this non-core asset and use the proceeds to fund our continued focus on infill assets, Ed Frisch, president and chief executive officer, said in a written statement. Duke Realty buys CenterPoint in Durham. 1 week after Duke Realty Corporation purchased the Greenfield North Industrial Park in Garner, the Indianapolis real estate investor has added another big warehouse property in Durham to its Triangle portfolio, paying $17.5 million for the CenterPoint 1 building on T.W. Alexander Drive. Medline Industries and Teleflex Medical occupy all of the space in the 324,000-square-foot building. Integrion lands $47.3 million defense contract. Integrion, a life sciences company in Research Triangle Park, has received a $43.7 million U.S. Department of Defense contract to continue developing a way to dry human plasma. The product is called Resuscix and would allow military personnel to dry and store blood plasma to then use in battle, if necessary. Integrion says its product is an improvement over fresh frozen plasma, another way to store plasma. "Our focus is to offer a safer and more effective alternative for frozen blood plasma, which often is not readily available in austere and remote locations," Integrion Chief Technology Officer Joseph DeCorda said in a statement. Red Hat to buy Gluster for $136 million. Red Hat Incorporated will acquire Gluster Incorporated for $136 million, the company announced Tuesday. Gluster will give Red Hat the ability to store more information, particularly on the cloud, a server-based system which allows users to access data from any device. "The explosion of big data and the new paradigm of cloud computing are converging, forcing IT to rethink storage investments that are cost-effective, manageable, and scale for the future," said Brian Stevens, CTO and Vice President, Worldwide Engineering at Red Hat, in a statement. And with our remaining seconds, we'll read a little bit of this article. Headline, "Small Businesses See Perks They Like in Obama Job Plan," written by Monica Chen with the Dayline of Durham. Provisions in the American Jobs Act touted by President Barack Obama could provide some relief to small businesses and startups squeezed by a lack of available credit, but consumer confidence remains a key issue. Jason Jolly, Research Director at the Center for Competitive Economies at UNC Chapel Hill, says consumer confidence is a significant obstacle to growth. Consumer confidence in September at 45.4 was still near the 45.2 in August, the lowest confidence level seen since April 2009. And we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. So long until next time.